Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guests today are Richard Olson and Cheyenne Olson. Richard Olson is chair of the board of Sustainable Berea, a community nonprofit and director of the Berea Urban Farm. He has advanced degrees in ecology and sustainable agriculture and many years of experience conducting basic and applied research in forest ecology. He recently retired from the faculty of Berea College, where he taught sustainability, environmental justice, and ecological restoration. Cheyenne Olson is Executive Director of Sustainable Berea. She received her Ph.D. in Communications from the University of Kentucky and secured a Fulbright postdoc in Australia to study the impact of Rupert Murdoch on the creation and presentation of news. Cheyenne has transformed her yard into an edible landscape and raised a small flock of chickens. In 2018, she designed and implemented Harvesting Hope, a job training program for women recovering from opioid addiction. So first, thank you for your work in the world, and second, thank you for being on the program.
You're very welcome.
Yeah, our pleasure.
So what is Sustainable Berea and where did it come from?
So Sustainable Berea started in 2005 with a group of people sitting around a coffee table thinking about the state of the world and what was happening that we didn't like. And we started with a film, The End of Suburbia, to gather people together to watch that. And the next big event we had was a rain barrel festival where we had an educational component with 15 nonprofits talking about water conservation and water management. And that kind of put Sustainable Berea on the scene in our community. And now we're in the rain barrel business, so we produce retrofitted rain barrels all year round. We have done a lot of projects to tap into our community and see what our community needs and wants. We've had guest lectures, we've had workshops, we've had 100-mile potlucks, we've had neighborhood food feasts, and reskilling exercises, classes. And what we keep coming back to is the importance of food and growing food, and we're constantly shocked because there are a lot of people who don't know where their food comes from. They think it comes from a grocery store and they don't want to eat anything that is, you know, in from the dirt, from the earth. So it's my opinion that we're very, very messed up because we've lost connection with the earth. We live, you know, in high rises and on cement, and we're just totally disconnected. So having people learn about food and grow food and harvest food and can food and do that with your neighbors builds community, makes our neighborhood safer, adds more vibrancy to our local food economy. And so we are getting ready to go into our fifth annual Berea Victory Garden Blitz, where we round up about 120 volunteers and they install raised beds in the yards of low-income families, and then we have a variety of classes to teach them how to use their raised beds. And so that's coming up in April. So we do a lot of things, Derek. we never rest. So, and then I'll give you to Richard, because we have a Berea Urban Farm and another major program, but he can tell you about those.
Yeah, and I just add that all of the things Cheyenne's been talking about are done with under the legal umbrella of a 501c3 nonprofit, a membership-based group. And so we look for ways to increase the resilience of the overall community in the face of all the different threats that you've written about for so long, anything from climate change to energy depletion, biosphere collapse, all those things. So, but as Cheyenne says, you can't do everything. So now we're focusing more on participating in the development of a local food system for Berea. So our sort of flagship project for that is the Berea Urban Farm, which is a 1.4-acre educational market garden right in the middle of Berea. This was an area of dilapidated houses, slum housing, really. And so between some private individuals and contribution from the city, the 1.4 acres was purchased, those buildings removed, and So we've been proceeding then. We've put in a lot of infrastructure, high tunnels, greenhouses, packing and washing a shed. So we call ourselves an educational market garden because we grow food. But the more important thing that we do is we teach people to grow food. Because really, in the end, the social capital, I think, is the real thing that we're trying to leverage to make a difference in the community. But we try to grow in a way that restores the land. It was a brown field when we got it. And now through bringing in and producing lots of compost, lots of cover crops, and we've built soil, we've improved the habitat. I saw more birds on the farm this past summer than I've ever seen. We create jobs and we build community. So the farm's an important part of our efforts.
So before I want to ask you more about the raised beds in a moment, but before we go there, I'm going to do two things at once. One is to ask you, what is the importance of food? Why food? And the other is to do a quote by John Mohawk that is, there is no sovereignty without food sovereignty, which kind of answers the question. But so can you take either of those anywhere you want?
Yeah, I'll go first, Derek. We live in a town that has two designated food deserts by the USDA. So we have a Walmart at one end of town, and we have a Save-A-Lot at the other end of town, and neither of those places have very good food. And in between those two places, we have lots of fast food restaurants and gas stations that sell junk, and people who do not have cars or transportation to either of those food places end up living off of fast food and junk food. 30% of the population in Berea lives under the national poverty level, and a local survey that was conducted by the Community Farm Alliance here in Berea 3 years ago showed that 50% of children under age 18 have experienced food insecurity in the last 2 years. So while people think that Berea is this wonderful place with a wealthy private liberal arts college, which that is true, a lot of people just don't see the other side of Berea, and it's the other side that we are concerned with. We have a huge opioid crisis in this area, which means where there are drugs and alcohol problems, there is theft, and we are having an escalation of theft, so we definitely need to make our neighborhoods stronger. And when you have gardening in your yard and your neighbor's yard, and you have your kids work in the garden and share the food, you build community and everybody becomes safer, and hopefully people have better health and better nutrition from the food that they produce. And, you know, even if they don't produce a lot, which nobody produces a lot, but some, and then you can share with other people and attack the diabetes problem. We have a lot of people that are overweight. Unfortunately, I do not have the numbers, the percentages on that, but you just walk around this town and look at people, and you walk around the town in California and you can see the difference. We have an obesity problem and a diabetes problem. Sugar, they call it the sugar problem. So that's where I'm coming from on that.
And I'll just add to that that, you know, as we work to make a more resilient community, I mean, a large part of that is so it's a bit self-serving, and that you want to be in a community that is set up to be better able to weather a lot of the stresses that are building. But you'd also like to contribute less to the genesis of these global problems. So quoting Wendell Berry, one of our Kentucky treasurers here, he said at one point, how we eat determines to a large extent how the world is used. And it just gets that agriculture is the biggest force for land use and degradation and large contributor to climate change. And also, it's not the world includes other species, livestock, mistreatment. And so to the extent that we can grow more of our own food locally in a humane and restorative way, it's just a little bit of a contribution to addressing some of these global problems that we often think there's, well, what could we do? Well, this is where we could start.
So tell me more about your raised bed program of giving those. Is what first, how long have you been doing it? How many have you put out? And then how many of those are still being used in a couple years and so on?
Yeah, Derek, we started the Berea Victory Garden Blitz in, let me see, it was 5 years ago, so that'd be 2013. Yeah. In 2013. And, we raise money from people who want to pay a bed forward. So it costs $100 to buy your own bed. That's the full price. And then it costs, then there's a sliding scale. We ask people to pay whatever they can pay. And people who can't pay anything have to pay $25. Well, every once in a while I let somebody slip through, but, we found that it's better if people pay something. So we have the same logo, the same dynamic bright yellow and green signage. It's like a stamp in the community. People know about the Blitz. We're going into our fifth year. We put it all over Facebook. We put posters all over town. I go to all the service clubs, you know, and the churches and everybody else and say, okay, the Blitz is coming. We need volunteers. You know, we need trucks. We need people to work for 2 days. We need people who can bring hammers and saws and shovels. And so we try to reach as many people in the community as possible and round people up, and then we get the lumber trucked in from a lumber mill that's about an hour and a half away, and we saw the boards and start constructing the beds. We have to pre-drill the holes and put the deck screws in, and then the next morning, so that's done on all day Friday, and then Saturday we start installing beds on Friday night, and then do the rest of Saturday, and then we have a big party, a big dinner. People cook food and bring it, and we have a dinner to celebrate the work that we've done. And sometimes it rains and makes it a little uncomfortable. But the first Blitz, we sold 137 beds. The second one, we sold 189 beds. The third one, we sold about 120. And then this last one, we were like right around 136 or 37. I was only going to do 100, but I couldn't stop. So it's really an amazing thing, because people go in their trucks with their beds and their dirt up to the haulers where the low-income family might be, and they've never been in a hauler, and they've never met somebody that lives in a house in the hauler. And so people get to meet each other, and the phrase, they're normally people who would not mix, is very appropriate. People really have a good time. They really like the Blitz, and so we're ready for year five. Did I answer all your questions? Oh, how many beds?
Total.
Oh, 502. I think it was the last time I counted, and that doesn't count the beds that we produce outside the Blitz. If you're rich and can afford a bed and you come to me and say, I want 6 beds for my backyard and I want double layers, blah, 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 I say, okay, we won't do those in the Blitz because you can pay for them. We'll take care of you after the Blitz or before the Blitz, usually after the Blitz. So that 502 are the beds that are produced in the Blitz, not all the beds that we've produced since we've been in bed producing business.
And what percentage of these do you think continue to be used, and what percent just get used once and then after that they're a kitty litter box?
You know, I am guessing that, you know, it's somewhere between 10 and 20% would not be in use. I do see beds. I know where most of the beds are. And in fact, today I went to the post office and I looked next door at the bank and they've taken their bed out, which I'm just going to have to go talk to someone about that, because if they would have asked me, I would have taken the bed and given it to someone. I don't know what they did with it, but it's not there. So sometimes people do take them out or don't use them. But I think it's a low percentage, very low percentage.
And Derek, I think what contributes to that pretty good success rate is we don't just plop beds down there. We offer a variety of workshops to teach people basic gardening. We provide handouts to them, little bags of measured out fertilizer with instructions. We will connect people with a garden mentor if they'd like somebody to come and, you know, just look what they're doing and give them some on-the-site advice. We're installing raised beds, but we're teaching people. And so those two things go hand in hand.
Yeah, and I wanted to throw in, too, I was just occurred to me. We put 20 beds in the Berea Community School for fifth graders. We put more than 20, probably close to 25 or 24, in a community garden that's just getting up and going. The East Ridge Garden we supplied with trees and beds when it got going. We've put beds in the daycare centers where people teach the kids to grow and eat the food. That's been a really fun project. And then we try to get them, we've got them in four or five churches around town. That's not very many because we've got about 70 churches, but four or five churches. And we encourage people to teach the children about growing food. So it's not just individuals, and we put them in front of businesses too. So we like to get raised beds everywhere.
Well, I think that next step sounds really important, because I know that when I have learned various types of gardening there's one level at which it's just really easy. I remember when I was a child, my mom giving me radish seeds, and of course radishes are great because they germinate so quickly. Everything is so fast. And there's that easy success, but then also when you convert to sort of real gardening, there can be a steep learning curve. So that's great that you also provide the other assistance.
And something else that we do also is a lot of people, you give them fresh food or whatever, don't really know what to do with it. You know, cooking has sort of fallen by the wayside as a skill a lot of people have. We don't teach home ec in the schools or whatever. So we have given basic cooking classes and worked with people to, if you grow it, well, here's what you can do with it then.
This is a less political question than many of mine, but I'm just curious. What do most people grow in their beds?
I think the main things you see, tomatoes are always a classic and a favorite. Sweet peppers, lettuce and other greens. Your radishes, that's a great example, fast. So I think those would be the main ones you'd see.
A lot of people do squash and cucumbers. And some people have two beds and they designate one for food for the pollinators.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. We're happy for people to do that. And we have some pollinator pathways on our farm, on the Berea Urban Farm, that show the names of the pollinators so people can take that little tour on that pollinator pathway and see the names of the flowers and plants that they like and can take those and plant them for the bees.
You know, I have I'm sorry, go ahead, please.
No, that's fine. I was done.
I have a friend who years ago taught fairly young children, and one time they took an elementary school group of children to botanical garden, and the children were running away terrified from butterflies because they thought the butterflies would bite them. And my point is that just the fact that you have people growing for pollinators is a huge step up from these other children I was just mentioning who were afraid of butterflies because they'd never seen butterflies.
Yeah.
Yeah, and people who, they're afraid of bees or whatever. Oh, they'll sting. If they start, all of a sudden they find themselves as a bee advocate. And they have a reason not to be afraid of them. So, one thing we found is there are all sorts of different, we call them hooks, way to get people involved, different entrance points into this type of work. And, you just have to try a lot of different things, and eventually you might find the thing that resonates with a particular person.
And what are some of the hooks that you use? I mean, is it the tomatoes taste better, or is it just the joy of seeing the little bugs, or what is it? What are some of the different hooks?
Well, one of the ones that we use, we have what we call the Neighborhood Heirloom Project. And Eastern Kentucky and the Appalachians is, really a hotbed of diversity, really, in certain crops because of the way the landscape broke people up, into small isolated groups. So within those, you had the development of different varieties, particularly of beans, also tomatoes. So we have our heirloom gardens for both beans and tomatoes where we'll grow them and we'll tell the story. Because some people who don't care beans about beans like culture and history. So I'll just give you one example. We grow one that's called the Conover Butterbean. And Mr. Conover was in the Union Army during the Civil War, stationed in New Orleans. And when the war ended, it was a little different back then, he had to walk back to Western Kentucky. On his way back, he collected seeds of butterbeans, which are sort of like lima beans for those who might not be familiar with them. So the butterbeans that we grow are direct descendants, the seeds he collected and have been growing ever since out in Western Kentucky, and now they are with us being grown. And those types of stories, resonate with some people, and by the end of the day, they might be interested in actually growing some. Another hook that we do is even people who don't cook or garden now, their grandparents did. I mean, almost guarantee it. And so you get them talking about, well, what did your grandma grow? Oh, well, she had these little tomatoes. I don't know what the names were, but and what did she cook? Oh, well, here she had this recipe that was, and you get them talking about that. And the point is, even in an area where most people don't currently grow food, there is still what I would call an agriculture. And you can tap into that and get those stories and those memories and maybe build on that to entice people to be growing.
And another thing, I should let Richard talk about this, but I'll just jump in here. In the district, which he'll talk about in a minute, Richard put up trellises in people's yards, in their front yard in some cases, or their backyard, and gave them heirloom beans, and they grew their beans. And there was this competition. People were, my beans are growing taller than your beans, while my beans are growing thicker than yours, while my soil. So it kind of spread through the neighborhood that we live in. And of course, we had our beans trellised here and a couple of different places on the farm. So that was fun to get people, and they'd never done beans before. So, and then of course they had their friends over and they all ate the beans, and so it was fun.
So that, I love the story about that naming of the beans. Can you just tell one more story about some heirloom strain?
Sure. We've got one. It's a white half runner, and it's from Pike County, and was actually, it was found in the crack between some boards in an abandoned house. Okay, they found some of these beans. It was sent then. We have this great resource in town. It's a Sustainable Mountain Agriculture Center, and where actually they've shifted their collection now because Bill Best is, getting older as we all are, so he shifted it to another place to carry it on. But he had 700 varieties of heirloom beans, 300 varieties of heirloom tomatoes. And so one of his was literally, they found four seed between the boards of an abandoned house. And he planted them, and one of them sprouted. And from that, then, there's this, pretty good bean now, which a fair number of people grow. So it's just the beans. I mean, I like to say that a seed, one of these bean seeds, it's a product of people, place, and time. You have families that have been growing these beans year after year, saving the seeds. The plants that do best are the ones adapted to their particular area. And so it's a bit of evolution there of a new variety. And we've lost a lot of that diversity for the same reasons we've lost it throughout agriculture. But I think Appalachia has retained more of that genetic diversity of these crops than a lot of places, just again, because of the way people are distributed across the landscape.
Yeah, and I want to throw in just another anecdote here. Bill Best, our lovely Bill Best, was at a conference having a dinner at some big hotel in Chicago or Kansas City or something like that. And he had a plate of food put in front of him, and there were four or five beans on the plate. And he tried to eat one, and it was totally disgusting. So he called the waiter over and said, I would like you to tell me about this bean. Where did you get it? Where did it come from? And he said, oh, we don't serve beans to be eaten. They're just a garnish. And that made Bill so mad. He was furious. He's told that story. I've heard him tell it several times.
But let me tell you, Derek, just for listeners who might not have had real beans, the beans that you get, at restaurants and all, they're very thin, right? Kind of pencil-like, stringy. It's because once the seeds start to develop in them, they become incredibly tough. You can't eat them. The only chance of eating them is to pick them really young. These heirloom beans, you can grow them out. The beans fully developed, the pods are still tender, which means you cook them and you get all that protein. They're a great protein source because the beans can be, you can let them fully develop like that. Mm. Or you can grow them out then, shell them for dried beans. And the taste is just, I sound like there's no zealot like a recent convert, but the taste really is incredible on some of these heirloom beans. And yeah, the ones you get at the restaurant, you'll never be able to face again.
Well, a couple stories about that. One is I moved to Northern California 20 years ago. And up until then, I always thought that berries were basically little overpriced packages of slightly sweet water, And now I live just, literally a half a mile from an organic blueberry farm that has these heirloom blueberries. And then right now I'm looking at blackberry bushes that are outside and huckleberry bushes, and I have become, as you say, a zealot for berries now because my point is, until I moved here, I had never had a berry. I had only had berry TM, sort of a industrial one. And then one more story is I've grown up in places that have never had warm nights. So Colorado, lived in Nevada, lived in Northern Idaho, and these are not places that really do tomatoes great. And so my experience of tomatoes was basically that they are garnish on a plate, kind of like those beans, that it's just provides a little bit of color on the plate and you can eat it, but it tastes like nothing. And then 2 years ago, I was at a feed store walking out and somebody had some heirloom tomatoes that they'd grown just up in the mountains where it stays warm at night during the summer. and they were selling them. I was like, what the heck, I'll just buy some. And all of a sudden, I didn't understand why anybody ever invented candy, because why would you have candy when you have tomatoes? Because they were the sweetest. I understood how people could perceive eating as an art form and also sort of cooking as an art form, because the tastes were delicate, they were ever shifting, and I'll stop my proselytizing about the glories of tomatoes now, but this is just, it's, there are a lot of foods that I don't like that when I've had them that were homegrown, that actually I found out that I never actually disliked this particular vegetable.
Yeah, I mean, I'm like that with butter beans. When I grew up in the north, we had lima beans. My mother would buy these blocks of frozen lima beans and serve them, and they tasted like sawdust, and I just hated them. So, but when I had my first butter beans that I'd grown, great.
So there's a book that I used to buy every year, and or every time they put one out, and I haven't bought it for years, but it was, I think it's called something like Seed Savers Handbook or something, and it was a catalog. I probably have the title wrong. It's a catalog of where you can buy different varieties of various vegetable seeds. And one of the things that always struck me about this is in the introduction, it said something to the effect of, the way to use this book is to figure out, you know, so you can buy a type of runner bean that you really like or a type of cucumber that you can really like. That's one way to use the book. Another way to use the book is to understand the loss of this diversity. So can you talk? I some people who listen to my show regularly might be wondering why we're caring about butter beans, but there's a collapse of diversity in vegetable varieties that is in many ways as striking as the collapse of biodiversity in general. Do you want to talk about that for just a moment? You have some, but can you talk about a little bit more?
Sure. Well, I mean, the driver behind the collapse of the loss of diversity in agricultural crops is, I mean, it's largely economically driven as we went to a more of a industrial agricultural model, and you want to grow huge areas of the same thing. You want to be able to harvest it green, so a machine can do it, and it can be shipped a long distance, and at least won't be rotten by the time it gets to the store. And so, you know, with that, as more and more people left the land as part of that movement into the cities, lost the connection with their own, the family farm and the seeds that they'd saved, then they were reliant on the industrial agriculture. And so you're down to, you know, a handful of varieties for some crops. I know for field corn, you look in the catalog, there's all these different numbers, you know, of varieties in there, but you look at the genetics and they all come from a couple primary sources. So we really are limiting the genetics. And why does that matter? Well, the next time the new tomato disease comes through, if all you've got is one or two varieties of tomatoes in most of the farms and those varieties are not resistant to that, I mean, ask the Irish how that worked for them, for their potatoes. So even if you're just totally self-serving and would like to have a secure food supply, then, I mean, diversity contributes to resilience. And as we lose diversity for various economic reasons, that's a problem.
So there's a couple topics I would like to still cover. We have like 15 minutes left. And one topic is, you've mentioned, not today, but you've mentioned to me before that about putting in fruit trees in the city. There's that I want to ask you about. And then in a moment, I want to ask you about how it's wonderful what you're doing. But when we've talked before, you also talked about how these efforts are insufficient. So I want you to be thinking about that while we first talk about the trees. So can you talk about your program to put in fruit and nut trees in the city?
Sure. We have, I'll preface it that I started including in some fruit and nut trees, probably back 2001 when I was still teaching at Berea College. And one of my students wanted as a project to put in a food forest. So we found a patch of college lawn and got permission, and she planted it, and it looks quite nice and quite productive now. And so we've been putting in trees ever since, but we're trying to formalize, well, we are formalizing it now into what we call the Neighborhood Perennials Project. So it's fruit and nut trees, also berry bushes, and pollinator supporting flowers, perennial flowers, natives where we can. So it's all of these things, and Berea as a city does not have a street tree program. The city does not plant or maintain trees along the streets, so. But a lot of people do on their own properties. So the feeling is, I mean, I love street trees. They provide shade. They look beautiful. But why not have something that provides shade, is beautiful, and drops food on your head when you walk by? So it's how can we get food production throughout all the little cracks and fissures in the community there? Make it integral to the infrastructure of the community. And we think there's a couple of things that are necessary for the success of this in the long term. One is that we only supply varieties that we know do well here. Stone fruits like peaches and all, they're problematic here because of various brown rots and things that happen. But apples can be good, sour cherries and all. But the point is, you don't want to just throw anything out there. You want to make sure that it's adapted to our, at least, current climate. That's a whole other problem. Climate's changing, so your choice of a 40-year tree has to take that into account. But the other thing is, you know, we raise money to provide very low-cost planting stock. But the worst thing we could do is just spread it out through the community, and a year later, most of it would be dead. So we will not provide planting stock unless, one, we've checked out the site and it's appropriate in terms of soil exposure and there's a water source nearby, and two, that there's somebody who's willing to take responsibility for that tree. Even if it's not on their property, maybe it's on public property or whatever, but they're willing to look out for it, to water it, particularly that first year, and call them tree guardians. So we hope this year will be the year we really ramp this program up. But the key is we're planting trees, but we're also creating a culture of stewardship. And that culture is what will make it a success, not just buying people a lot of free trees.
This is all so brilliant. I just love this. And I love the way you have been able to, I mean, I don't know if this has been trial and error that you've learned, as I do, only through making 100 mistakes, but, I mean, it's brilliant to have a tree guardian to make sure, because my idea would have been, well, I'm just going to go out and plant a tree and then I'll walk away, but I think it's, everything you're doing on that is just brilliant to get the community. It's, as you said, you're creating a culture as much as you're creating shade.
Right, and, I'm sure I read about other places that, you know, I don't come up with a whole lot of original ideas, but I read a lot, and, unfortunately I can't remember where I might have gotten the idea, but, plus I've made the mistakes too of just planting trees isn't this fun, and there they go. But yeah, I think it's, your crop is educated, engaged, skilled people as much as it is fruit trees.
So how does this actually work? So, the apple tree is now 15 years old or whatever. It's old enough to grow fruit, and it's on the street. And so do just random people, when they're walking down the street, they pick an apple and eat it? How does that work?
Well, it's going to depend, you know, where it is. Certainly anything that's adjacent to a sidewalk, and all the expectation is that people, you know, are welcome to pick, although even there, it would help to have signage, for instance, with apples. If you just rip it off there and you break the fruiting spur off, well, then you've just decreased the productivity of the tree. So you almost have to educate passers-by. You are welcome to pick. First of all, when it looks like this, it's ripe. And second of all, grab it with your thumb here and twist. So, you know, it's, there are some things you just can't avoid, those shortcuts. And if it's on some, a lot of these are on private property and yards and all, and then it's just, you know, when we plant them on private property, it's owned then by the landowner. They've agreed to watch out for it and all, but if they decide to cut it down the next year, there's nothing we can do. So you got to recognize when you put these out there that some of them aren't going to make it. I think we've had, if we go back over all the years I've been putting them out and I went back now, there's maybe 70% of the trees are still there, which is pretty good.
And how long have you been planting the trees?
Well, I think the first ones went in 2001, 2002, and then it's been sort of sporadic since. And then more recently, in the last few years, we've kind of geared up again. So we've got a fair amount of younger stuff there. But for instance, we put in 10 trees along the walkway into the community school here, and two of them died after 2 years. They'd lost two. But I didn't think that was too bad.
So when we, the three of us, talked earlier this month, and at that time you expressed that, I mean, and I think all the work you're doing is fantastic, and at the same time you were saying that they're also, that the, what you're doing is, that, that you also recognize the limitations, that, that, that this is necessary but not sufficient, I think the logicians would say. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, this is an ongoing point of discussion, both in our household and with the broader community. But I'm a believer in, you know, lay out the facts, please, even if they're, you know, not the brightest future. So, for instance, food growing. Wow, we've got some fruit trees now in Berean. We've got these raised beds. And but by my estimate, it takes 80,000 pounds of food a day to feed the city of Berean. Okay, do the math, you know, all the raised beds we put out and everything, you know, and maybe we grow a week's worth of food each year. Okay, so, but that's to me, that's just necessary information. If our goal really is to have, we'll never be self-sufficient, but what would be a significant contribution to both food security and health and aesthetics and everything? And so maybe that's 20% of your food if you could grow. Well, you have to know what 20% is to know if you're meeting your goal. So yeah, I think you need to be somewhat blunt in laying out what the reality is. But then Wendell Berry, again, I can always come back to Wendell Berry for a great quote on things, but he has an essay called A Poem of Difficult Hope. And it addresses the question of, you know, why do something if all the evidence suggests that it's probably not going to be enough? Right? And so I recommend everybody that they might read this essay, but the last sentence of the essay is what always grabs me, where he says, if we would help if we could, we will help when we can. And that's just, yeah, I mean, we want to help. We want to make a difference. This is what we can do. So let's do it.
Yeah, and Derek, I want to just mention a little bit about the Harvesting Hope project that we have started. It started this. We've done three classes so far, and we've got five more to go in 2019. But the research shows that there are 220 counties in the United States that are labeled as distressed. 54 of those are in Kentucky, which means 25% of the distressed counties in the nation are here. You know that the opioid epidemic is a real crisis in this nation. In fact, the latest statistics show that the leading cause of death for Americans under 55 is overdose because of opioid addicts. Every 11 minutes, another life is lost. And the opioid epidemic killed more people than those in the war in Vietnam and Iraq combined. So we have a problem, and it's really comforting for me to know that we have an organization called Sustainable Berea that can adapt to issues that are critical that are facing our community, that are health issues, education issues, whatever. So Harvesting Hope works in 4-week segments with 4 women, and they work on the farm, and they get paid. So they learn how to show up for work, and Richard is their boss, so he makes sure that they have the educational component of learning as well as working. And then we teach them how to balance a checkbook. They do financial literacy. They go and talk to nonprofits. They go and work with business people and hear their stories. It's a really fast and hard and full program. And we've run 12 women through, and 4 of them are missing. They're not with us anymore. So that just shows us how hard it is. We've got 8 that are strong and 4 that are out there doing what they do. But it shows our community that we're responsive. It shows people that we need to do something to help the community, to make the community more resilient. And, you know, the drug crisis is going to overrun all of us if we don't get our communities together to do something to address the issues. So, it's never enough. No, it's never enough. It's not enough. You know, running 32 women through a program is not going to save Berea from opioid addiction, but at least maybe somebody else will see what we've done and talk to us, and they can start their own program. In fact, we got invited to Sterling, Illinois 2 weeks ago and went up there and talked to the mayor and the city councilor about a lot of issues, the opioid program and the tree program in particular. So, you know, you just keep reaching out and finding people that are like-minded, and that's what we do instead of sitting around watching TV. We don't have a TV.
Well, that's one of the reasons that I wanted to interview you, is because I really have a similar feeling about this, that of course my writing is insufficient to stop the destruction of the planet, and any timber sale appeals that somebody does, or lawsuits stopping dams, it's all insufficient by itself. But I have no patience for the people who use the argument that, well, it's not sufficient, so let's party, or let's not. They use that as an excuse to do nothing. So I love the fact that you are both honest enough to recognize that the work is insufficient, but still honest enough to know that you have to do what you have to do as one part of it. And an image that I always love and I think about constantly for social change has to do, it actually is quite apropos for this conversation, that I always sort of look at social change as a stew. That you throw in your butter beans and, you know, I throw in some German butterball potatoes, and somebody else throws in their contribution, and then we all just hope to hell that it ends up tasting good. So, you know, I have a friend who used to run the battered women's program for the state of New York, and before that she ran a battered women's shelter, and she does wonderful, wonderful work. It's Charlotte Watson. And I would never ask her to work on salmon issues or issues of dams on the Columbia, like my friends John and Rachel Osborne, or John Osborne and Rachel Pascal. We all have different contributions to bring in, even though we recognize that they're insufficient. So, I mean, do you want to take that anywhere?
Well,
yeah. I think going along with that, sometimes it seems like we, and by we, I'll say the people who are activists and in various ways, are sometimes our own worst enemies, because we can become hypercritical of each other and, say, well, really you could do better than that and everything. But, you know, there's such a huge difference between somebody who does something and somebody who does nothing that really I think we need to support each other. And there's a lot of good work being done out there. And, yeah, is it going to... Well, I don't know. There's probably not the great glorious tomorrow of continuing the we know the industrial economy won't continue. But I do hope that if enough of us do things, that it will help something good to make it through to the other side. And I don't know what that will be, but I think it'll be more than would happen if we don't do it.
Well, that's exactly it. And I have a good friend who, John Osborne, who always says that the reason he does his environmental work is because, quote, as things become increasingly chaotic, he wants to make sure that some doors remain open. And what he means by that is that if bull trout are still around in 10 years, they may still be around in the hunter. But if they're gone in 10 years, they're gone forever. And it's the same with if a patch of old growth is still standing in 10 years, it may be there in 100, but if it's gone in 10, it's gone. And we can say the exact same things about these heirloom butter beans. And you know, all of my work, every bit of my work is based on one simple thing, which is that this way of living won't last, and when this way of living is over, I would prefer that there is more of the natural world left than less. That's it. And we can say the exact same thing, that as the industrial economy collapses, I have no doubt that people who live in Berea would rather that there were fruit trees there and would rather that they had those strains of butter beans than not. Yeah. It's really that simple for me.
Yeah.
So we're pretty much done. So do you have any final words for people? Or how about one final word from each of you?
No, I'm just thinking, I think it's important to find people who are like-minded or can be educated enough to be like-minded. I think people are afraid and scared and maybe even terrified about what's going on in the world, and people need to be nurtured and taken care of and encouraged, and we need to celebrate whatever little things that we can do to celebrate the earth, to celebrate the food, to celebrate the animals. And that's something that I always try to get Sustainable Berea to be engaged with, is people reaching out to other people to sort of enlarge the clan, and so that the clan can go out and bring other people to the group, because I think we all need encouragement and support.
And I'll just add to that that everybody who's an activist needs to remind themselves once in a while what led them to the particular area of activism they do. If you're trying to save the bull trout, it's probably because you thought the bull trout was a pretty cool creature and enjoyed studying it and all. And we need to just take the time to remember that and to enjoy what we do. If you only do it because, by God, if I don't do this, it's all going to fall apart. You'll fall apart soon. But so I need to go out there sometimes in the garden and just enjoy growing those beans or whatever, you know, and forget for a while that, you know, I'm doing it in the face of all these problems.
So I kind of lied, because I now have one more question, which is if somebody in Belton, Texas, or Las Cruces, New Mexico, or Fresno, California wants to reproduce or wants to start a similar program, how would you suggest that they get started to create a, you know, sustainable Brookings or sustainable Medford or sustainable Belton or wherever?
Okay, well, there's a couple of things. One, they're always welcome to call us, go to the website, Sustainable Berea, get our contact information. But beyond that, there's an organization called Transition U.S. And the Transition Communities Movement, which started in England and spread to the U.S., is a network, really, of a lot of like-minded groups trying to make their communities more resilient and sustainable. So go to transitionus.org, look at the stories there, you know, see what's worked other places that might work where your community is. Recognizing your community is not exactly like anybody else's, so what will work, you've got to modify what's worked elsewhere for yours. But there's a lot of people working hard on these same basic goals, and so network. Don't try to do it in a vacuum.
Well, thank you so much for all of your work, and thank you for everything you've said today and for being on the program. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guests today have been Cheyenne Olson and Richard Olson. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.